Welcome to Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio. Each week we bring you news, comments, and insights from Bloomberg View's global team of editors and columnists. I'm your host, Pim Fox. This week we're going to take a look at golf. Yes, the USGA, the U.S. Golf Association, is considering rules that would make the game faster and supposedly easier to play. We'll also examine the Trump administration's focus on deregulation and reform. And also on the program, we hear about five ways that passive investing is actually very active. And that's all coming up. But first, tax reform is all the rage right now in Washington, D.C., including conversation and debate over a border adjustment tax proposal from the Speaker of the House, Representative Paul Ryan. Ryan had this to say at a press conference in January.
All we're doing is putting ourselves at a more level competitive playing field so that American businesses and American jobs can compete. If we as American workers and American businesses are putting ourselves in a level competitive playing field, we're going to do great.
All right. But will the strengthening U.S. dollar crimp their plans? Here to tell us more is Bloomberg View columnist Gary Schilling. He is the president of A. Gary Schilling and Company. He is the author of The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation, and a contributor to Bloomberg View. Gary, always a pleasure. Maybe we'll start with taxes and income taxes, corporate taxes, and so on, and then we'll get to border taxes, border adjustments, and so on. Maybe let's start with what the proposal is from the Trump administration having to do with income taxes.
Well, it's by the House so far, and the administration hasn't exactly weighed in on this with an official response, but they seem disposed. And, you know, Paul Ryan and the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady, they said their aim is, and this is a quote, "A tax code simpler, fairer, and flatter, so simple that most Americans can do their taxes on a form as simple as a postcard." I don't know how H&R Block comes out on that deal. But they really are looking for tax simplification. And they have a number of proposals along that line, reducing the number of tax brackets for individuals. Deductions would go down to only charitable contributions and mortgage interest. It would eliminate the so-called death tax, the inheritance tax, the gift tax, a number of changes. And then on the corporate side, reducing the rate from 35% to 20%. And
well, then there's the repatriation, right? Perhaps yeah, a 10% tax on money that's repatriated.
That, so encouraging people to bring the money home. So there are a number of things that make a lot of sense in this in terms of simplification. Now, I might add, Pim, that this is a recurring situation. We go through waves of tax desimplification, complication, and then things get so bad that there's simplification. We had in 1986, there were 15 individual tax brackets, and the massive simplification went down to only four. And I got to tell you, I thought that was wonderful.
Well, maybe if we aim for complication, we'll get simplification, because that seems to happen much of the time. Do you think that either the corporate tax or the income tax reform, is that something that you would expect, let's say, in the next 6 months?
Probably not in the next 6 months. No. Steven Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, said he wanted it done by August. He said it may slip to the end of the year. And my question is, and I mentioned in my column, which year?
Right.
I think it's going to take longer than that, because there are a lot of people who are not happy about what they're proposing. And it's a complicated area, and there are going to a lot of people weigh in. And then, of course, you got the whole question how you pay for it. And that's a border adjustment, and that's what really is the key issue here, the way they're doing this, because they're doing this under a budget resolution. If they did it on a regular law, they'd have to have 60 votes in the Senate. They can't get those with a filibuster. There are only 52 Republican senators, and so they do it under a continuing budget resolution. They don't need only a majority of votes. But it has to be revenue neutral, and that's where the border adjustment comes in, because that's supposed to pay for all the tax cuts in the corporate and individual area.
Well, just explain, if you can, what a border adjustment tax would do in your estimation to the U.S. dollar, if anything.
it would it would increase the value of the dollar, maybe. Now, the proponents of this assume that it will push up the value of the dollar to basically offset the fact that the tax would be would not apply to exports, but would apply to imports. And they believe that when the dust settles, that the dollar, in effect, if it's a 20% tax, then that the dollar increases 25%, because 20% down, 25% up, you're even. And that everybody rides off into the sunset. And all that happens is that those who export to the U.S. pay $120 billion a year, $1 trillion in a decade, and that supports the whole tax cuts. The only problem with this is they're assuming that there is a one-for-one adjustment of the dollar with the trade balance. And historically, and I've got a graph in the article that you've seen, there's absolutely no correlation between the current account balance, which is a more inclusive trade balance, and the dollar's value. There's so many other things that push the dollar around. I mean, only about 1% of the dollar, 1.4% of the daily transactions in the dollar have anything to do with U.S. trade. The rest are everybody else's trade and all the capital flows. So this kind of ideal world where you can put in this border adjustment and assume the dollar adjusts one for one, and there's no such thing as free lunch, and this is a classic case, Tim.
Thanks very much. Gary Schilling, always shedding some realism on plans to change legislation. He's a columnist for Bloomberg View. He's also the president of A. Gary Schilling and Company and the author of The Age of Deleveraging: Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. In late February, President Donald Trump signed an executive order that will establish regulatory reform officers and task forces within U.S. agencies in order to implement the regulatory policies of this and prior presidents.
Every regulation should have to pass a simple test. Does it make life better or safer for American workers or consumers? If the answer is no, we will be getting rid of it and getting rid of it quickly.
Here to tell us more about this reform is Cass Sunstein. He is a Bloomberg View columnist and the author of a new book entitled #Republic. Well, Cass Sunstein, tell us exactly about this regulatory effort on the part of the Trump administration. What is it designed to do?
The basic goal, to have an organized process for eliminating regulations that aren't helping people. And it tells them, you know, get organized, try to think of things that are burdensome, that are redundant, that are inconsistent, that are imposing costs, that are in excess of benefits, and figure it out and report within a certain time to the high-level policy officials, and we'll try to figure out what we should get rid of.
Can you speak to the context in which presidential advisor Stephen Bannon said that one of the principal goals of the Trump administration is the deconstruction of the administrative state? What does that mean?
Well, I hope it doesn't mean a whole lot. The word deconstruction, as I understand it, comes from a French theorist named Derrida, who publicized it, and probably Mr. Bannon isn't trying to reflect postmodern literary thought. So what I think he's trying to get across is there's some regulatory activity out there that isn't helping anybody, that's imposing burdens on small business and others, and we ought to take another look at that. Now, the word deconstruction, in addition to having this odd heritage, it's pretty inflammatory talk. And probably the best way to understand it, given the Trump executive order, which I think is actually promising, is we're going to have a real process for figuring out whether things that are on the books, whether they involve, you know, air quality or worker safety or the electricity sector, we're going to try to figure out whether those are helping anybody. And as the executive order is written, it's very pragmatic and kind of technical in an impressive way, rather than provocative and red meat stuff.
Have we had previous efforts on the part of presidents to do similar things?
We definitely have. So actually, the most ambitious effort, which I was fortunate enough to have some involvement in under President Obama, was called the Regulatory Look Back. And President Obama's effort to clear out regulations, which hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, has succeeded in eliminating over $20 billion in regulatory costs. And President Obama actually regularized the look back process. So every 6 months, you have to come up with a new set of ideas for streamlining the system. President Reagan and President Bush, both of them actually, and President Clinton made some efforts in this direction. So the basic idea is it does have precedence, but clearly Trump is trying to ramp it up. And if it's done right, he's going to deliver some real benefits for people. It's to be hoped, not by taking away things that protect health and the environment and safety. That's very important stuff. But by taking away things that are really outmoded or overlapping with other things that are in place, or that even though they're a little bit helpful, are more harmful than helpful.
How precise is our ability to determine the future costs of things related to safety and health?
I'd say precise enough. It's a great question. So if you're doing something that involves, let's say, worker safety, maybe you're taking away some regulation that is designed to protect workers against a carcinogen, you might not know whether taking away that protection is going to save, going to result in no deaths or a significant number of deaths. But a prudent path to cross, I think, is one where you say that you are going to take away things if it's demonstrable that they are costly and the benefits don't justify the costs, and you're not going to take away things that are benefiting people big time and that's demonstrable and the costs aren't so high as to make those benefits not worth incurring, then you can have some gray areas where you don't know a whole lot, and that's not the low-hanging fruit. My hope is that the Trump administration will begin, as the Obama administration actually did, by looking where can we work with the private sector and with people who actually know how things are working on the ground to take away things that are really not helping anybody, but are burdening small businesses and large businesses.
Would changes to the requirements for automobile manufacturers, miles per gallon, would that fall under the same category? Because that's something that the Trump administration has already signaled that they are going to do, which is to get rid of those requirements that were put forth by the Obama administration.
I think for the Trump administration, that is not low-hanging fruit, and that requires some very careful deliberation. And let me say why. The fuel economy standards are ones that are delivering a lot of benefits to the American people. If you're driving a car that's more fuel efficient than otherwise would be, you're saving a lot of money at the pump, and you might be, over the course of ownership, saving thousands of dollars. And that's something you don't want to reverse that helpful policy. It's also true that the fuel economy standards are reducing air pollution in America, and they are reducing greenhouse gases in America. And even if you're not that worried about climate change, as many of the Trump advisors apparently aren't, the actual benefits of the fuel economy rule are mostly benefits for consumers and benefits in terms of human health effects that are good. You know, that they're reducing air pollution that makes people sick. So that one seems to me one where the technical analysis is currently supportive of the fuel economy standards. Now, it's completely fair for the Trump administration to take another look and to see if the analysis actually withstands its own scrutiny. But there are other things that seem a lot more obvious candidates for deregulation than that one.
Thank you very much, Cass Sunstein. And actually, Cass, before you go, you have a new book out. It is entitled Hashtag Republic. What can you tell us about it, please?
Well, thank you for that. So the book is about polarization in America and the extent to which lots of people are living in echo chambers. They may be people who are following on their Twitter feed, people who think that Trump is, you know, doing fantastically, and that's all they read, or people who think that Trump is horrible, and that's all they read. And the book is really about how it's very important in a democracy for people to have a respectful and, to the extent possible, sympathetic understanding of people who disagree with them.
Thank you very much. Cass Sunstein is a columnist for Bloomberg View and the author of the new book entitled Hashtag Republic. Has investing been taken over by robots? The debate, active versus passive investing, is one of the most contentiously debated topics in the investment world right now. Chris Ailman, chief investment officer of CalSTRS, said this on Bloomberg Television just this past January.
If you're a retirement investor just put your money in a passive index. It's the lowest cost option in your 401k or your 403b, and then just ride out the market for the long term. Don't try and play ETFs. Don't try and play active management.
But is passive investing more active than many people believe? Here to tell us more is Eric Balchunas, ETF analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence and a contributor to Bloomberg View. Eric, always a pleasure. The first line of your column is the rise of the machines, attack of the clones. Is that really what passive investing is all about?
Well, those are some of the phrases you hear in headlines that I think investors and the media and the industry has sort of come back with in terms of being a little nervous about this whole trend, because it is in full throttle right now in terms of the amount of money that's moving over to so-called passive.
All right. Well, you list five ways that passive investing is actually very active. Let's begin with number one, index construction. Tell us about it.
Right. So if you talk to academics, right, people who are schooled in theory of finance, passive by definition is anything other than having, you know, all the stocks market cap weighted. Well, no index really does that. Maybe there's one or two that maybe the Russell 3000 comes close, but that means that really nothing is truly passive. So when you look at in the indices that we all take as gospel, like, for example, the S&P 500, okay, sure, it's an index, but it's constructed in very specific ways. When does it rebalance? How does it reconstitute? Are there limits in it? All these are made by humans. And in the case of S&P 500, there's actually a committee that picks which stocks go in and out. So you actually have a team of people picking stocks. In some ways, the S&P is a bit active.
Well, that leads us to number two, which is a portfolio management. Explain how that has a human hand.
This one was really interesting. If you think about who runs an index fund, right, like the Vanguard manager or the BlackRock manager who runs a fund that tracks an index, you just kind of assume it's nobody or maybe a computer. But it's not. There's actually humans, and they play what I call as a game of basis points. So it's very, very active in a way in that they have to play defense. They have to look out for spinoffs and dividends and things going on in the index. You have to, make sure you keep up with all that.
Yeah, but hang on just a second, Eric, because I mean, if these things are happening and there is a rule behind what to do, you're asking someone to follow a playbook rather than give you their impression or their strategy. They are executing what has already been determined. Doesn't that make it passive?
Yes. So here's where we're going to differentiate on the word active. So in the first one, I think we were more in the academic world. In this case, what I'm trying to do is lift a veil on the fact that it's not an industry of robots. In this case, I'm just saying that there is a human being who is doing things in an effort to track the index. But I will say that where the activity, I think, really comes into play is how an index manager, a passive manager, is trying to actually tie the index. So they have to sort of eat up the expense ratio, or they try to, in order to get closer to perfect tracking. And they do this through securities lending. And some of them are so good that are in a rebalance, they can actually pick up a basis point. So I'm just saying there's a ton of activity and human beings running the index and passive funds. And it does take skill. It's not just a robot.
Let's talk about number three, usage in portfolios. How does that work?
Essentially, you have ETFs and you have index funds. Let's just say they're index investing, we'll call it. The decision on how much weighting to have each asset class in your portfolio is the most active decision an investor can make. The Brinson study from the 80s said that 89% of your returns come from your asset allocation decisions and only 11% from the securities you select. Thus, even if you're using all, quote, passive tools like ETFs and index funds, the weighting that you pick, whether to go 35% equities or 50, is a much more important active decision than actually what's in the ETF or what exactly the stock selection is. So I think that is also a really legit point of view on how index and passive investing is being used very actively.
All right. Well, you can check out numbers 4 and 5 by reading Eric's column. I want to thank you very much, Eric Balchunas. He is the ETF analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence and a contributor to Bloomberg View. President Donald Trump and some of his campaign officials are being investigated for ties to Russia. This comes after intelligence officials concluded last December that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, had interfered in the U.S. elections. But should the U.S. Congress actually take the lead in this investigation? Here to tell us more is Eli Lake. He is a columnist for Bloomberg View, and he joins us now. Eli, maybe you can just set out exactly what it is the investigation is proposing to uncover, and currently, what are some of the legal restrictions on who can actually do this investigation?
Well, the investigation is actually pretty wide-ranging. It started as a probe into what the extent of the Russians' influence campaign against the 2016 election. What has happened really beginning in December and really kind of hitting a high dudgeon in the last week or so has been a spate of leaks that have suggested that there were extensive ties or contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russian officials. And some of this has been exacerbated by the fact that, you know, under oath, people like Jeff Sessions did not initially say that they had meetings with the Russian ambassador. There was the Michael Flynn affair where he had to resign after less than a month. So what you now have is Democrats calling for a special prosecutor to look into the claims of collusion between Russians and the Trump team. And then you also have a kind of, you know, effort on the part of these intelligence committees to include this as part of their mandate. And that's the thing I really want to focus on.
Well, what do you say to Democrats, Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee, who may feel that FBI Director James Comey is not impartial and that even the results of whatever investigation the FBI finds, even if it finds nothing, are prejudiced by his continued presence at the FBI?
I don't think that that really holds water, and there are a couple reasons for that. First of all, James Comey was appointed by Barack Obama in part because he did not go along with the George W. Bush administration pressure to authorize large-scale collection of metadata in the United States. Before the Congress had approved this through changes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act laws.
You mean you're saying that because Comey was an appointee of the Obama administration, Democrats shouldn't worry about him?
Well, not just because he was an appointee of the Obama administration. It's because he was appointed by the Obama administration because he's shown independence at a moment where he was pressured by a Republican White House to sign off on something that, you know, he believed was not constitutional when he was the deputy attorney general. His boss, John Ashcroft at the time, was in the hospital incapacitated. And they, you know, he literally went to Ashcroft's hospital room to stop what he thought was an effort to try to basically short circuit the process of the Justice Department approving, some of these post 9/11 intelligence programs, in this case, NSA wiretapping thing. So that is why he was appointed by Obama, and that because he had this important moment in his career where he showed that he was willing to take on the president, you know, who the president who appointed him into the job of deputy attorney general. What's more, I think there's a lot of evidence here that Comey is independent. He's already shown that, you know, he declined, or his deputy McCabe declined a White House request to tell the press publicly. There was nothing to some of these New York Times stories. So I think Comey has proven in a lot of ways that he's independent. So I don't think that in this case that's a fair criticism that Comey would somehow not follow every lead and the FBI wouldn't necessarily do it. But it also doesn't address the fundamental point, which is that the House and the Senate Intelligence Committees, or for that matter any committee in Congress, is not in a position to do the kind of investigation that a law enforcement agency can do. They are not their job is not to collect intelligence. Their job is to oversee the institutions that do collect intelligence. And if you have Congress in a situation where they are collecting intelligence on what they believe to be disloyal American citizens who are acting for a foreign power, I hate to say it, but we've seen that movie before. It's called McCarthyism. So, I mean, it's not good to get Congress involved in that, because Congress, by its very nature, is totally political, and it's also out in the open. So those are two things you don't want if you don't know and you want to find out if Americans have been disloyal to their country. That's the reason why we have the FBI do this under the shroud of secrecy. It's one of the, I'm against a lot of state secrecy. I think we have too many secrets. This is one area where absolutely those investigations, because, you know, just the allegation alone is so deadly and so tough on someone's reputation, and you have to keep that in secret when you do it. So I don't think that Congress should be the ones doing this kind of thing.
Thanks very much. Eli Lake, a columnist for Bloomberg View, giving us his view on investigation into links, potential links between Russians and the Trump campaign. Now we want to turn our attention to what is probably the most difficult and perhaps most satisfying game, golf. The United States Golf Association is considering cutting the game's main regulations to 24 from 34. Most of the changes are aimed at speeding up the pace of play. So why is the USGA so concerned with pursuing a faster game? Here to tell us more is Toby Harshaw, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Toby, I got to start off by asking you, what's your handicap?
Not on the radio, Pim, but I do have to say that if you find golf to be one of the most satisfying games, your handicap's definitely lower than mine.
All right, well put. Let's start off then with perhaps something that you may have encountered on the golf course, which is looking for an errant ball. I understand that there are regulations that might be changed that would, well, speed up the play when it comes for looking for that ball.
The actual rule is currently that you have 5 minutes
to look for the ball.
To look for the ball. If you don't find it, then you take the penalty. The new rule would be 3 minutes, and that, of course, does have an effect with professional and amateur tournaments. Unfortunately, I doubt that one's going to trickle down to country club players, because people usually spend a very long time looking for a lost ball, far longer than they should.
What's the goal here? I mean, is this a kind of an effort to take a page out of George H.W. Bush's golf program? I mean, didn't he finish 18 holes in 51 minutes?
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants to turn speed golf into a sport. I don't think the USGA wants that. But I mean, it's been a very, very interesting couple of decades for U.S. golf and world golf. Starting with Tiger Woods and a whole, you know, boon of great new technology that made it easier for hackers to play. Golf went through this. You know, radical increase in
Big
in,
Bertha drivers,
exactly, the whole
Tiger Woods on every magazine yeah. cover and a celebrity, and then the fall off.
Then the fall off, and you know, I think Tiger's fall from grace was mostly symbolic of this. I think the real problem was the time commitment. I think people realized that no matter how good the technology was getting, you just were not going to master this game unless you played 2, 3, 4 times a week.
Some of the other rule changes involve the sand trap.
Yeah, another thing that I have some experience with.
By just watching other golfers,
by
of
watching
course,
other
yes.
golfers. Yeah, well, unlike the pros who often hit the ball into the sand intentionally because they love getting out of it so easily, the rest of us can hack away, especially if there's, you know, a big lip in front of us over and over again. As an alternative to that, you can now simply pull the ball out of the green, give it a drop back behind.
Out of the sand trap.
Out of the sand trap. Yep. Mm-hmm. Give it a drop no closer to the pin than the back of the sand trap and take a 2-stroke penalty, which, you know, if you played courses like the Blue Monster at Doral and seen those kinds of sand traps, that's a lifesaver.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the pin, because that is also the subject of a potential rule change. I always love it when people spend a lot of time, you know, going to the pin, taking it out, putting it. That's a
Yeah, you know, and it so rarely makes a difference to whether a putt's going to go in, you know, or not, whether the flag stick is in the pin or not. It can be helpful, I guess, sometimes if you're chipping on, so you would want it in. But it's rarely an advantage to have it in, even if you're taking a long putt. It's just as likely to knock a good putt away as it is to.
But the
to
new try. Rule would be
the new
you
rule
can
would
leave
be
it in.
You can leave it in, right? So you don't have these foursomes spending a lot of time over who's going to pull the pin out and where does it go. And because people just spend way too much time on the greens.
Because there are usually four people behind you who have a very, very specific attitude towards your time and your use of it.
Exactly. And that, you know, as you said, this is about the traps. This is about the greens. This is the bottleneck on every hole is all that play right on and around the green.
And whose turn is it? Are we going to get a little bit of that as well? Because it used to be who's ever furthest from the hole, that's whose turn it is.
Yeah, and now there's an encouragement to play ready golf. I doubt they'll do that in the pros. But it makes a lot of sense just to not have to stand on...
To stand around, waiting for someone else.
Yeah, the old formality that on the green you can waste a lot of time deciding who's out. The association says these rules are all for simplification. Actually, that's not a simplifying rule. It was easier to say whoever's furthest out goes next. This is to speed up. And I think a lot of these things are being dressed as simplification when what they are is about accelerating things.
Thank you very much. Toby Harshaw, a columnist for Bloomberg View, and we'll call him a pretty good golfer. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio. You can read more at BloombergView.com and at ViewGo on the Bloomberg Terminal. For Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio, I'm Pim Fox. Our producer is Samara Lenga. Thank you for listening, and remember to tune into the next edition of Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio.